Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 7 of 10 nonfiction paperback bestsellers are memoirs or autobiographies. That says something about ourselves as readers and also as writers. For all the attention paid to fiction, we seem to crave the real deal, the memoir. Later on, we'll meet an 87-year-old accidental memoirist and learn about his journey. Joining us now to talk about the increased interest in the memoir and how to go about writing your own is author and teacher Thomas Larson. Thomas is holding a workshop on memoir writing in a few days in Worthington. To learn more about that, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me.
There's this impression that the memoir has risen in significance, but it's been around for a long time. It's been popular. Has it risen in significance?
Well, when we say the memoir has been around a long time, I think what we mean is that the autobiography, its progenitor, the original form, is what's been around for a long time. And we should really distinguish between an autobiography and a memoir. And, of course, autobiographies are written by famous people, people who have had renown in public life, and the autobiography is often the private musings of that public life. So consequently, there weren't a lot of autobiographies written in previous centuries, just because there weren't that many famous people that would have constituted, having a life worthy of telling the whole story from birth to last night. So what's happened basically is the memoir has arisen in the last 20 years as a kind of part of, but also a counter to the autobiography, because memoir is a focused story about the meaning and intensity of a single relationship in a person's life. Relationship with a parent or a child, relationship with an illness, relationship with a phase or era such as childhood or adolescence. So it's much more of a focused form than the very broad autobiography.
Is then anyone a candidate for a memoir?
Well, I think anyone's life is a candidate, because I think all of our lives are fascinating, and we certainly love to tell stories about ourselves, partly true, partly fiction. I think you really have to have an affinity for language, for wanting to play with sentences and paragraphs in terms of composing a memoir. A memoir is so internally rich in its probative value that when people start, they soon find that they're not just recording their lives, they are literally starting to see their lives and understand them, which is a lot different than just remembering things of the past. Sometimes we talk about memoir as an activity that records or chronicles the past, but I like to think of it as a present activity in which you're making all these discoveries about who you are versus who you were, how your relationships have changed over time. So whether or not people have the stamina to go deep into memoir writing will differ with different people, but it certainly brings their this confessional mode of self-reflection and self-discovery to the fore. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's rewarding, but it's not easy.
My guest is Thomas Larson. He's author of The Memoir and The Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. What do you mean by personal narrative?
Well, personal narrative is just another way to say this is a story that happened to you. You're telling us a story that is based in actuality. It really happened. You're not inventing it. You're recalling it and setting it down with some scenic elements, dialogue and description and action. And so a personal narrative gives the stress to the word narrative, which is really storytelling. All memoirs certainly are not start to finish sort of six-gun shooting tales. You know, they're all not heroic stories about winning the lottery or scoring the final touchdown. Those are rather droll and uninteresting kinds of things. Narrative is important because there is something that unfolds in a memoir. It may be the past, but it also may be this interaction with the present and this idea that I speak of, self-discovery.
Yeah, you talk about in your workshops the idea of personal growth. Can you give me an example of someone in one of your workshops maybe going in with one impression of what they would get out of it and walking away with something very different?
Oh, sure, yes. This happens regularly. It's sort of surprised me enough to want to write to include this in my book. I remember one writer I worked with in San Diego who came in and basically wanted to tell the story of this failed marriage, which she was just in the process of getting out of. She thought that was her subject, which is fine. It makes a good subject. It's a little tough to write about when it's perhaps a little too fresh. But once she started into the project, she found herself flashing back to childhood. And, she would write one chapter and then another chapter, and they were all focused about her and her brother growing up in this family in Milwaukee. They were Serbian ethnicity. There were Serbs, mm-hmm. but they had a sort of community in Milwaukee. And she found herself starting to tell the tale of her childhood. So suddenly, what she thought was a memoir about her marriage was turned into a narrative about childhood. And she really started to see that before she could really talk about her divorce, she really had to go back and sort of unpack this relationship with her brother and her parents that was quite fraught and difficult. And in many ways, she grew from this person who saw herself having made this terrible decision to marry this particular man, that so much of her self-understanding and character had been formed in childhood. So she really grew in this process. She had no idea that that her childhood would mean more to her in her writing than writing about the recent past.
So sort of like therapy.
Yes, you cannot write a personal narrative or memoir or autobiography without having some element of therapy. A lot of people go into it for that reason, it's another reason why we do workshops and people form groups, because the idea of writing about your life and then sharing it with others is quite therapeutic. But to be clear about that, I'm not a psychologist. I don't mm-hmm. I don't concentrate on the therapy in workshops. I concentrate on the writing. But you cannot separate the two things. They're interwoven, and they're part of the broader therapy culture. Memoir, I think, is a very active daughter of that culture, which seeks to find the self in a culture that tends to drown out the ordinary in favor of the famous. So thus its incredible appeal to so many millions of people who feel they have something. Not only do they want to say and get off their chest about themselves, but also it's a way to uncover what it is they want to say.
Can you tell us what you think a great memoir is out there that maybe people would be familiar with, and tell us why, what made it great?
Yes. I'll give you two quick examples just because they're male and female. Mary Carr's The Liars Club from 1995, which is a great memoir because she recalls her childhood with a crazy mother and an absent but loving father. And she recalls her growing up in this small Texas town when she was between 4 and 6 years old. The reason why it's such a good memoir is not only because of her language and her storytelling ability, but she wakes up in the end, in the last long chapter of the memoir, to the meaning of this childhood. She just doesn't bust the story of this long ago thing that happened, I think, in the late 50s. But she sort of wakes up to its importance in her life, her sister's life, and in her mother's life. And it becomes kind of a family memoir whereby everyone sort of is empowered, if that's the right word, or deepened. Their relationships are deepened because Mary has written this book. It's just a fabulous, fabulous work of nonfiction. And another one from recent time is Michael Greenberg's Hurry Down Sunshine. And this is an example of what I call a sudden memoir. A sudden memoir is a memoir that looks at a very recent event in the past. In other words, you don't have to write about something long ago, but mm-hmm. but it's something very recent, sometimes something, an event that one is still going through. And it is the story of his daughter's psychotic breakdown. She's about 16 years old in New York City one summer when she goes from bad to worse to worst and comes back out of it within 3 months. She has to go into a psychiatric hospital. And this, of course, causes him no end of angst and pain. His ex-wife is involved, his own family's involved, and his own, the frailty of himself, the vulnerability of his thinking that he's going to lose this daughter to madness. Oh, it's just an incredible page-turner. And yet it's a very kind of brave, courageous book that seeks to understand what is very hard to understand, because he's literally, it's just happened to him, and he's sort of setting it down. But a lot of listeners Eat, Pray, Love, and that's a good example of a sudden memoir where she goes away for a year, comes back, and then writes about that year immediately and sort of sets it down as her the major transformation in her life.
There's the Julie and Julia phenomenon, too, the blogging, the as it happens, almost.
Yeah.
Kind of, I guess. Is that a form of a memoir as well?
Oh, sure. There's many varieties, mm-hmm. and there's a whole smorgasbord or menu of things to choose from for the adventuresome memoir writer. I put it all under this broad category of life writing, and I think life writing is just a fascinating subject that is different from literature. Literature is this high and mighty form of classic communication that exists, like almost like classical music. But there's all kinds of other forms of life writing: diaries and journals, blogs, confessions, letters, emails. We're just starting to have an amalgamation of all these different forms and recombinations of different forms, because people have written about themselves for a long, long time. But now we have this, you name something and you give it reality, you give mm-hmm. it verity. And by naming memoir, this thing, which is essentially contemporary writing about the self, you can do all kinds of different forms. I'm always fascinated to see how the form is changing before our very eyes.
We have to take a break right now. My guest has been Thomas Larson. He is author of The Memoir and The Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. He has a workshop coming up this week. You can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides and get more information about that. When we return, we will meet a life writer from The Greatest Generation. And also, I'd like to invite our listeners to participate. We can't hear everybody's life story on the show today, but if you could limit it to 6 words, what would you say? There is a book, it's called Can You Tell Your Life Story in Exactly 6 Words, or it's called It's All Changed in an Instant. What would your life story be in six words? If you know what that would be, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Thomas Larson will return with the show in a few minutes, and we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Join a discussion this Wednesday at 6 p.m. with WOSU's Ann Fisher about what's hot and what's not in German Village today. It's the German Village Town Hall Meeting. The Columbus Neighborhoods event is free and open to the public. For more information, visit WOSU.org. And we hope to see you there this Wednesday at 6 p.m.
Support for WOSU comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
57 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a nice day with a high of 66. Clear skies tonight, a low of 38 degrees. Sunny skies and another nice day tomorrow with a high of 67. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us now is Walden Farnham. He's 87, born and raised in Toledo. He served in the U.S. Army during World War II and was a self-employed engineer and surveyor until his retirement in 1989. He's been married 63 years, and he's the father of five children. Val began writing his memoir in 2008 and completed it a year ago. He's with us in the studio right now to talk about that experience. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You didn't intend to write anything at first. What was the original
The original goal? Thought was that my daughter and one of my grandsons were going to tape us. They were journalists, and they were going to tape and record parts of our life story. And I said that I would write a few notes down, and I began writing, and I wrote for over a year.
13 legal pads. You did it by hand. You didn't use a computer.
No, I don't type, so I letter. And, the lettering is quite legible, so the typist does not have to worry about not being able to read my notes.
During the process did you realize that it was more than just a list of ideas that you wanted to mention in an interview?
It wasn't very long, because when I started writing, the pen would not stop. And every time I had a moment, I got out my legal pad and continued to write. And my wife would say, "Why do you keep writing?" And I say, "Would you rather have a husband with Alzheimer's?"
Were you surprised at some of the things you came up with?
Yes, I was.
Give me an example of something that surprised you about your memories or...
One of the big surprises, and I noted it in the first gentleman's comments, that you do learn something from writing your memoirs. And the big thing I learned was the part that my wife really played in raising my children. It was really revealing. And I was very thankful for that. There are the things I found out about myself, but I don't know if I can corner them just a second.
So it was the idea that when you sat down to write about what your wife Marge had done, you felt
well,
it
Well, I realized, you know, that the kids came home every noon for lunch. I was down at the corner restaurant or hot dog place having a quick lunch, because I never took a long lunch. But something that you don't realize today is all the kids in our day came home from school for a school lunch. And part of our problem, this is another thing I've learned, that our society has completely changed in many ways since my day. And a lot of it, I do not see much good in what is happening.
Did you ever get to do that interview with your daughter and your grandson? Did you ever end up doing any of that?
They guided me along the way.
Okay.
I learned a few English things that I should be doing as I write. I was repeating a lot of things.
How did you decide what to say? How would stories occur to you?
The good Lord just put them in my mind as I wrote. I tried to write chronological, but I do not do that completely. When I thought of something that happened in the past, I put a break in the story. I said, well, I forgot back there and so, and then I complete what my thought that I have at the time, because many of your thoughts come to you as you go. And as a matter of fact, after I wrote my book, I have a few afterthoughts, and the new printing will contain those.
Did Thomas Larson, the gentleman I was talking with earlier, and he'll join us in a little while, he notes in his book that we recall things differently through different life stages. Were you surprised at what you remembered and how you remembered it in your late 80s versus what you might have said about it in your 40s?
I found that I remembered more about the 40s than I did the 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
However, our lifestyle had changed in the early 90s, and it was a duplicate pattern each year of we go to Florida and we return to our home, and as a result, your vacation trips are limited to visiting your children. So, it was much easier to remember those things from the past for myself than the last 20 years.
Was there anything, Mr. Farnham, that you left out on purpose?
Yes, there is.
You don't have to tell us what it was, but can you tell us why?
Why?
What sort of thing was it that you didn't want?
It's rather personal.
Okay. So personal things that you didn't think...
It would have made a good story. One heck of a good story.
Mm-hmm.
But I it's too personal to talk about it.
Okay. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now is Valdon Farnham. He is we're talking about his memoir, what he wrote in 1 year on 13 legal pads with a fine point pen. It filled about 250 pages of a book. Would you like to read part of that for us now?
Okay.
Read a little excerpt.
I can do that very well.
By the way, the title of his memoir, Just
A While Ago.
Just A While Ago. That's Margie Farnham. His daughter's with us. Just A While Ago. This is by Valdon Farnham.
This pertains to my trip across the sea during World War II. On the morning of October 23rd, we found ourselves at sea on the Atlantic. In every direction, all one could see were ships, troop ships, navy ships, cargo ships. This convoy of ships must have been miles long. We are on the troop ship Brazil with a few thousand men on board. The Brazil was a converted cruise ship, and several of us were crowded into a small cabin. We slept navy fashion in stacked bunks. Those prone to seasickness always got a bottom bunk. Some of the infantry had to sleep in shifts. Fortunately, I was not one of those who got seasick. It would be not be smooth sailing as the roughness of the sea increased daily. It seemed as though the naval ships were half under the water most of the time. I was told that since it was the fall time of the year, the heavy seas were not likely to abate. At least we were a larger ship. As we continued on our sea venture and ocean crossing, I must tell you a couple of the missing luxuries. With an overcrowded cabin, we had to trade, being out on deck part of the day. Most days were cold, some rainy, and many included plenty of ocean spray. There would be little washing and no showers until we reached England. Early on, some of the fellows played craps out on deck. Myself, I was just playing cold when I had to be outside.
That's Walden Farnham reading from his memoir just a while ago. If you have a question or comment for our guest, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What was the hardest part about doing this? Was there a hard part?
About writing this?
Mm-hmm. Because you're not a writer. You're
some days you could write. Some days you pick up your pad, and there was just nothing there in the mind to jot down. But the next time you picked it up, you didn't want to stop.
There's sometimes people use questions to get them started. Did anyone do that for you, give you prompts and say, why don't you tell us about, you know, your happiest moments with the children, that kind of thing?
With my family?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy, there's so many happy times that it's hard to pick one. But one thing I did with my family is we traveled a lot, and they have all seen this country.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a few problems. Biggest problem I ever had traveling was when the kids were small, and it was hard to decide who was going to sit next to the window. But I feel I gave my, through these travels, I gave my family and education and a good time. And I think they all remember those days.
You know, also with us is Margie Farnham, Walden Farnham's daughter. Margie, you're a journalist. You are the one that suggested he maybe jot down a few things because you wanted to interview him for posterity. Were you surprised by what he came up with?
Very surprised. When I mentioned that I wanted to videotape him along with my mother, I kept thinking I wanted to do it, and I was going to borrow my nephew's camera, and we were just going to sit down and do some reminiscing. I wanted it for the grandkids and the great-grandkids because I thought they have such great stories to tell. And he called me one day and said, do you still want to videotape us? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I started an outline, and I said, okay. He said, is that okay? And I said, well, sure, but I was just, you know, going to ask you questions. But go ahead and write. And then he would call another day and say, well, I have 17 pages. And I thought, 17 pages? Well, okay, should I keep writing? I said, yes, keep writing. Then he'd call and say, I'm up to 33. And at that point, I figured it was going to continue for a while. And I think he started in the fall of 07 after we did some discussing, and then it took me about a year to write, get everything on the computer. And for me, being a journalist, it was hard not to edit too much. And I realized at a certain point that I really wanted it to be his words and his voice, because there have been people who are close friends of the family who have said, when I read it, I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really important.
It definitely has a definite voice. But in the totality, it is probably differs from, it's more of a chronological accounting in a way, maybe a little bit different than a memoir in that way, that it's not focused on a question or a topic in somebody's life. But was there a story, an overarching story for you when you read the whole thing?
I learned a lot more about his experiences in the war than I had known. I knew, you know, that he had lived in Germany and stayed in a barracks there, and we actually visited that town when I was 11 years old, and I knew that he had relationships there, but I didn't know the stories of sitting in a foxhole. And there isn't really one. Having grown up not far from where he grew up, it was fun to hear some of the stories of playing with neighborhood children on streets that I also played on. I think the stories of his life in school as a young boy, really, I had times when I would be typing and I would laugh out loud. And I had other times when I would be writing and I had tears coming down my cheek. So it was a great experience. I got to know him in a very much different light.
Mr. Farnham, we have to take another break, but I was wondering if you could read a little bit more. I think it's the addendum to it. It's the ending, I suppose.
Okay.
And we can pull that one off. And do we have that?
We can do that.
All right. And then we'll take a break. This is Walden Farnham reading from his his memoir just a while ago.
It's a fair question. It's a fair question. I never wrote much more than I had to in school. When my children went to college, I never wrote many letters. I just paid tuition and sent money. I suppose a lot of it has to do with the words on a card I gave to my wife, Marge, for her 84th birthday. With a few revisions, they became my words. Once there was a guy, a nice guy really, he met this girl, an incredible girl, a truly amazing girl. Naturally, the guy fell head over heels in love with her. Pretty soon they were picking out rings, china platters, and take note, wherever pots and pans. That will ring a bell with many of you. Then there was a wedding, and the starry-eyed couple rode off into what would be a rosy future. Okay, so now much time has passed, and the guy is living in the distant future. He's still married to this girl. However, now their life has included a lot of stuff. Children, in-laws, friends, his own business with understanding partners, traveling the States and Europe with many trips to Florida. Appliances, bills, loads of laundry, and home repair projects. Between all the to-dos and have-tos, there are these moments when the guy stops for a moment and looks around him. He looks at his wife, who continues to be truly amazing. He looks at his life together and all the ways and the directions it has grown. He looks at all the responsibilities he has had, and he thinks to himself, "So this has been my life?" And then he thinks, "I have been one hell of a lucky guy."
Thank you, Walden Farnham, for joining us today. I appreciate you sharing your words.
I appreciate the opportunity.
We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
In 1972, Congress launched a program granting medical coverage, including dialysis, to virtually anyone diagnosed with kidney failure. According to a new investigative article for ProPublica and The Atlantic, this program has evolved into a hulking monster that expresses the health care reform fears of both the left and the right. We'll hear more on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Tonight at 8 on WOSU TV, NOVA investigates new discoveries about the origin of dogs. New research reveals what dog lovers have suspected all along. These furry friends both read and respond to human emotions. Watch NOVA tonight at 8 on WOSU TV.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer, dedicated to giving back to the community with the Simply Give Food Pantry program. Meijer will match our customers' donations up to $100,000 to help restock local food pantries.
58 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:41. Sunny skies today, a high of 66. Clear skies tonight, a low of 38 degrees. More sunshine for Wednesday, another nice day with a high of 67. And looking ahead to Veterans Day, sunshine and a high near 70 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Joining us again is Thomas Larson. He's author of the memoir and the memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. Thanks again for being with us, Tom.
Yes, hi.
We have two six-word stories that have blown in, one by email from Jan, strengthened by the people I love, and another one from Hungry Wolf on Twitter, dual national transplant geographer, rower, foodie. If anyone else has some six-word memoirs or autobiographies, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, of course, you can go to Twitter, Ann Fisher, WOSU, should get you where you need to go. And we have, of course, we're on Facebook as well. This is an email from Alex, writes, are some of the listeners scanning documents and pictures into digital files? For example, I have been scanning old family photos, and I recently found some typed autobiographies from my father and grandmother, which I will scan into files that I could send to other family members. In that way, they will exist beyond the single paper copies here at the house. That kind of documentation, Tom, I've felt that way about some really old stuff I've found, old pictures and old letters that have inspired me to write more.
Yes, indeed, to write more. And if I can comment on Mr. Farnham and his beautifully titled story just a while ago, I think the listeners heard a not uncommon example of a writer's a person's emotional connection to their lives and what's important in our lives through writing. And he's the kind of a guy who sort of became a writer by filling up these legal pads of his. And I just think it was wonderful to hear how this family sort of grew closer because of his project and the daughter's supporting and kind of assent in the whole endeavor and saying, yeah, just keep going, see what happens. And I just sort of applaud his willingness to venture into this material. And there's a good reason to write a piece. I mean, you asked me earlier if someone should, if everyone should write a memoir. I don't know about everyone, but certainly anyone can. And he's a great example of just of pushing through and letting it come back. It really touched him deeply, this appreciation he has for his wife and his family and his life, and also the formative element of the Second World War. This is very, very big with men of that generation. If they were in the war, they often tend to write about that experience at length.
In writing a memoir, I think with Mr. Farnham, it was he knew his audience was going to be his family. But otherwise, what should one think of when they think of who's going to read about it? What about the audience? Should they be writing for themselves or for others?
Well, it's never either or. I mean, writing for the self, what makes us cry will make other people cry. What makes us laugh will make others laugh. I think both private and public in your writing that this we want to know who you are in particular. We don't want your life as a representation of something, of an era. We want your particular thoughts and feelings at these difficult or smooth junctures in your life. And there's another interesting thing about this. You know, the Farnham family will have in the future, they will have this book of their grandfather or great grandfather as the generations unfurl. And, you know, I don't have anything of my grandmother. I loved my grandmother, and I have her chair, and I have recipes, and I have some of her jewelry, but I don't have this written record from her. And I don't have letters either, so I don't have that personal element. But the Farnham family actually has this personal testimony of his life. What a wonderful thing, not only for them, but for the culture, because you know, as people, as we go on and we look back at these, as you can call them documents, I think they're more important than document. I think they're in a sense they have a more sacredness about them because they're personal testimonies of people who have lived through difficult times. And you know, we probably have 10, 20, 30,000 of these sort of nameless World War II memoirs, or memoirs that are focused on the Second World War, or even more recent wars, and that is a trove of insight and you know, emotional depth that future generations are going to get to look at, and I just think that's wonderful to have that. We had the same thing with the letters of pioneer women when those were finally investigated and sort of researched and published. So we do some of that from, shall we say, the 19th century.
You know, there's such a we don't write letters anymore.
Yeah.
But more people are writing things like these memoirs and these life stories, and maybe that can stop the gap a little bit.
Yeah, they are. More and more people are doing this. Email is a form of that. I think, you know, there's some of that can survive. I don't know if we want how much of that we want to go through. But certainly it survives in the public realm, which I think is very interesting, that there will be a gazillion bits of information on email in the public realm. But, yeah, the idea of memoir writing certainly has either replaced or jumped into the lacuna of letter writing, and the culture changes. You know, we should bring up, which I'm sure your listeners are aware of, things like video diaries or video memoirs, writing with video, writing with sound, writing with audio, doing oral histories, and so on. And that is to me as wonderful, because then you preserve not only the sound of Mr. Farnham's voice while he's reading and remembering and sort of making discoveries through his voice, but you also get this rich sense of remembered history. So I just think we have to, we don't need to privilege literate texts as much as I think we think we need to, but I think other forms, especially uses of personal testimony and video and audio, that the younger generation understands completely.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Thomas Larson. He's author of The Memoir and The Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. And Alan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking the call. A couple things that interest me. First of all, I wanted to remind you that you have a life writer specialist on your staff, in the person of Joy Riley, who's a regular contributor to WOSU.
Right.
Who conducts life writing workshops annually, and working with a large number of folks.
Okay. Well, everybody's familiar with Joy Riley, who listens to WOSU. We thank you for that call, Alan.
And I'd also like to mention that the Lawrence and Lee Institute in the Special Collections Library at the Ohio State has about 60 hours of oral histories taped with members of the original touring company of Porgy and Bess in the 1950s.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it's the company that made Leontine Price a star and was the first American theater company to travel to the Soviet Union. It was on the road touring for about 6 years. Okay. There's a huge collection of material there, and we were able to conduct oral histories with a whole bunch of the members of the cast while they were still with us.
Okay.
So that's that. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Alan. 614-292-8513, or you can Email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Lance, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You're on the air with Thomas Larson.
Yes, thank you very much. I wrote an ethical will for my children and ended up being a biography of my life. And so can you discuss an ethical will as being an opportunity to also describe the great events in your life that formed you and poems that might have affected you and the bully, the quarrel in the schoolyard that changed you and so forth and so on?
Well, would you say more about an ethical will? I've heard about it, but I don't know what it is exactly. You must understand it.
Oh, I see. Well, it's a you start out with your will, and then you amplify it. You explain it sort of explains why your will is written the way it is, why you're maybe divvying up your property. It gives the background to your life so that your children and anyone else can better understand your frame of mind at the moment. But because the will is such an important document to everyone involved, it's also an opportunity to plant family history, record it, that may have only been talked about or never talked about. And it's a chance to pass on through your will the background to your father and mother and relatives and other influential people in your life.
That's an interesting framework. It's probably been done before, but not necessarily. I mean, where people, you know, you read stories like that, where the it's the flashback kind of a story.
Yes, but for some reason it's called an ethical will.
Yeah.
There's the books written on ethical wills.
Thomas, what do you think?
Well, this is fascinating. Again, it's another form that the life writing is morphing into. And what I think it's interesting, I like his word plant, this idea that you can you have your say in your will beyond just the divvying up or donating of your property, and that really what you're doing is you're using the will to say what it is you believe in. And
yes, exactly.
And the will, what the ethical will is asking you to do is to put it in writing. So it's posing this question: well, what do I believe in? If I'm going to leave $10,000, let's say a radio station that plays classical music, then I'm going to say why I'm leaving that money to them. Because when I was young and I studied the piano with so-and-so and so on, it just gives you this opportunity to, make ethical or make actual the feelings behind the division of property. I think it's fascinating.
Thank you, Lance, for that call. I appreciate it. If you'd like to make a call, we have about four more minutes left, maybe a little bit of time, 614-292-8513. We have a six-word memoir from Jeff on Twitter: Minneapolis, West, East, Finland, Columbus, moving. That's kind of fun. Have you heard of that before, Thomas?
Well, I've heard the six-word memoir, yeah. But my six-word memoirs is, okay, now you've got the start. You've got the germ or the seed,
yeah.
And put that in the middle of a piece of paper. Circle it and start brainstorming. And I bet anyone can cover that page in an hour with stories, ideas, feelings, and so on. That is a wonderful way to sort of launch one's thinking about writing a memoir. After all, a lot of people don't have time necessarily to devote to it as much as a full-time writer. So this is something you have to start thinking about. You want to wake up or go to sleep with thinking about it and start composing in your head. And it's a good way to get the ball rolling.
There are accounts like, the famous Jane phrase, a million little pieces. It was sold off as being 100% true and then later found not to be necessarily false, but maybe, I don't know, exaggerated.
Yeah, that's a good word.
And what's that balance? Because It's funny, you know, when I, you know, you tell people about your dreams, and I've had these couple dreams I always tell people about, and then I went back and actually wrote about them when they occurred, and I thought I had them not all wrong, but they weren't what I remembered them. I remember them differently now than I did back then when they occurred.
Right. Yeah. Well,
it's not a lie, but
no, it's not a lie. And someone has famously said that, you know, memory has its own story to tell. And I think as I talk about in my book, that the longer our lives, the more we remember, and the more we remember, the more we change, rehearse, remember, in the strict use of that term, different parts of the past. We start to stitch them together. We bring in our friends' and family's versions, and so on. It's one of the reasons Thanksgiving dinner can be so fascinating or so awful, because you get the family around, and they start remembering the tale differently, and one will say, oh, you know, but I was Dad's favorite, not you. And we literally can grow up in the same family. I have seen this hundreds of times. Yeah. People grow up in the same family and have different memories and different relationships with different people. It's just the way life is. The way to work with it as a writer is just to be honest about that. You know, when I'll write a line, for instance, I won't just say I was my father's favorite. I will write, I was my father's favorite, but my brother disagrees with me. And so I have a way of bringing in his point of view into my text, which is, after all, the point of view is from my personal perspective. And the idea that memoir then is not just this personal vindictive thing where you're trying to get back at everybody. It's actually a work of a community of rememberers. You know, I think it's good to talk to people, friends and family, about what you remember and how you remember, and see what they say about it. They may have a different take on it, and both takes can be true. The problem with James Fry was that he didn't bother to do that. He just exaggerated things and hoped he wouldn't be caught. But, you know, you're going to be tried by Google no matter what. Mm-hmm, if you put facts in there, Google is people are going to be able to go to a web search and check on things. So you have to be ultra careful about these kinds of things and be more communitarian about it, not so much just private.
Okay, we have two more from Twitter. We have two more six-word memoirs. One from Twitter is Escape Small Town, Follow My Heart. And the other one from email from Paul is Lived, Loved, Learned, Seen, Still Do. Those are nice. That's nice. I appreciate everybody who wrote in or emailed or Twittered or Facebooked us their six-word memoirs today. And my thanks also to Thomas Larson, author of The Memoir and The Memoirist, Reading and Writing Personal Narrative. He has a workshop coming up this week in Central Ohio. You can learn more about that on WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have what you need to get you there. And my thanks as well to Valden Farnum and his daughter Margie Farnum for being with us today. Thanks to everybody. And that's all the time we have. Thanks again, Thomas.
You're welcome.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.